Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to a Peak Prosperity podcast. This is your host, Chris Martinson, and today we get to welcome back Paul Brodsky, co-founder and co-managing member of QB Asset Management. Prior to QB Asset Management, Paul has spent several decades trading bonds and other securities for such Wall Street firms as Drexel Burnham Lambert, Kidder Peabody, and Spyglass Capital. If our economy or financial markets fall into true crisis, the bond market is where the real action will play out. And the European bond market is now flashing warning signs that such a crisis may be in the process of unfolding. Hey, Paul, thanks for returning as a guest.
It's my pleasure, Chris. Glad to talk.
Awesome. Well, let's begin with your macro outlook. Recovery or recession, healing or hemorrhaging, where are we in your estimation in the macro global story?
Well, obviously, it's a very complicated, complex series of discrete, tangled events that are playing out in the political sphere as well as the economic and monetary policy sphere. And where we come down on this whole thing is it's impossible to have a political solution to a balance sheet problem. And this is nothing new. We've been discussing this and writing about this for years now, since probably 2006. And it appears to us that, you know, there is debt, there are coupon payments, and no amount of political or policy intervention can take that away, unless there's a formal jubilee, which obviously we don't see. But where we think this is going, and it seems to be accelerating, is that politicians, policymakers, and the public are starting to recognize that this issue cannot be mandated away. There are creditors that expect to be paid, and there are debtors that are having an increasingly difficult time paying them. So we're looking at balance sheets. We are thinking that the fundamental driver of value across asset classes reduces to this gap we're seeing not only in the U.S. but in Europe and in Asia as well, separating bank assets and base money. Base money, as I'm sure many of your listeners know, is comprised of currency in circulation plus bank reserves that are held at central banks. And that's at the Fed, or that's at the ECB, or that's at the Bank of Japan, so on and so forth. Bank of England, this is how we work. This is how the global economy rolls, as they say. So the amount of bank assets, and of course bank assets are loans, mostly. And so the amounts globally are staggering. Something approaching $100 trillion in global bank assets. And in the U.S., we think that's somewhere around $20 trillion held in the U.S. and abroad. And the big numbers for monetary base are much, much lower, specifically in bank reserves. That is the amount of reserves that are collateralizing, if you will, all of those $100 trillion in bank assets, something about $8.5, $9 trillion. So that gives you a sense of perspective as to how much the global banking system is leveraged. And it also kind of leads into a sense of where incentives are. Bank incentives to lend, you know, and that doesn't only go to the private sector, but that also goes to the public sector. I mean, we are in a baseless monetary system, and money, as you've written about, so often and so frequently. Money is lent into existence, and it all has to happen through the banking system. So the fact that this mechanism that we use to create and issue and distribute currency is so highly levered, well, we think it just flows through to the real economy. And I think that's a very broad view of what we feel are the drivers of economic data, of economic behavior, because it goes directly to incentives both in the public and the private sector. In business as well as consumption and as well as monetary and fiscal policy.
Well, one of the ways that you can get out of a balance sheet difficulty, let's say you've got, a lot of loans on there. The classic way is to grow your way out. And so we're seeing a number of key thrusts right now globally. Global growth, obviously, is on my macro view. All my dashboards say it's at stall speed in the U.S. and it's actually in negative territory elsewhere for the most part. And so here we are on, Thursday, July 5th, and what we're seeing is China just cut rates. The ECB has now got interest rates at historic lows. The main deposit rates, I guess, at 0.75%, deposit facilities at zero. The Bank of England just tossed a little bit more money into the game over there. So we're seeing a lot of efforts to stimulate our way out. Is this, but in your view, we have a balance sheet problem. We levered up. We probably overextended ourselves. From my view, it looks like several decades of borrowing at a faster rate than our income was growing, and that's a math problem that catches up with you. Is it your estimation that that has caught up with us?
I think it has, and I think it's accelerating, Chris. I mean, when we talk about growth, when we look at growth, the world and certainly the capital markets have been trained to look nominally, in nominal sense. And we can look at, you brought up before, sovereign yields. I mean, in the U.S., you know, we clearly have, even if you use the BLS's version of CPI, which is the official version, of course, you know, we have negative real yields out in 10 years. If you were to use a CPI version that shadow government statistics use, John Williams, that calculates CPI in the same manner they did prior to 1980, it comes out to something approaching 7%. 8% negative real yields. And so this is a very fundamental issue. So when we talk about growth, if we were to take, and generally when we talk about growth, people are thinking output growth or obviously GDP. When we apply these inflation rates to nominal output growth, nominal GDP, we come up also with negative real growth. And so it's very, very easy to see the gumming up, this viscous sense of growth. There are two ways to produce growth in GDP. One is through increasing unit sales and through increasing transactions that lead within consumption. And that is the healthy way. That implies that there is economic activity. The more transactions, the more consumption, the more unit sales there are. That obviously leads to higher employment. The other way is through higher prices. And you can have higher prices and you can have a slowing economy. Yet, you can still have what looks nominally to be output growth. And so we've seen that since 2008. As oil has come down and as gasoline prices have come down more recently, obviously we're seeing output growth in nominal terms come down as well. And that's all good for consumers. But it really doesn't make up for the lack of incentives on the part of employers to hire and the lack of incentive on the part of public and private potential borrowers to borrow to expand their businesses or to expand their consumption. And so we are seeing the real economy contract. And this is not only in the U.S., this is obviously in Europe. It's going on in Asia as well, as we're seeing in China and other sovereign nations.
Well, you know, almost all of these bailout efforts I've seen, the ones directed at Greece, the ones at Spain, et cetera, almost all of them have baked into their proposals as to how they're supposed to work a rapid resumption to real growth. I saw that, I think it was just 6 months ago when they were first starting to really bite into the Greek bailout. I saw charts that said there was an expectation that Greece would basically flatline this year and be back to 2, 3, 4% growth starting next year. And that clearly doesn't seem to be in the cards. So without this growth, what happens to these balance sheets?
Well, I think the only solution has to be creating more bank reserves, creating more base money. First, it's bank reserves. Second, it's going to be probably physical currency. We have, when we look at, and let's come back to the United States because we have very good data and it's easily consolidated. But when we look at the United States, we see bank reserves held at the Fed of about $1.7 trillion. Now, it used to be zero. I mean, they used to not keep reserves at all, the banks, and we had a completely fractionally reserved banking system. Now we have, since QE's, we see about $1.7 trillion in reserves, as I said, on bank assets of about $20 trillion. When we further look at deposits, it's about $10 trillion. Actually, theoretically, it's really $20 trillion, because for every asset, there's a liability. So, you know, we could say it's $20 trillion. That is still tremendously fractionally reserved. In other words, and the bottom line on all that is there are, you know, $18 trillion in deposits. However, it's backed by, you know, not quite $2 trillion in reserves. Doesn't really mean that there's going to be a bank run tomorrow because everyone doesn't need all their money at once. And it doesn't really mean that there should be a bank run tomorrow. But what it does mean is that the pressures on the banking system are so great to produce returns on deposits that are already highly levered that, as you say, the math just can't work. And this, we feel, is the nexus of the problem. It all comes back to the banking system. We found it very interesting watching yesterday's testimony by Bob Dimon and the vitriol that the politicians, the British politicians, seem to throw at not necessarily Bob Dimon because he's a decent guy and he was very forthcoming, it seemed, but seem to be throwing at the banking system. And we think that that's the beginning of what we've been calling for, where you're going to start to have a food fight among the bank system and banking systems and governments and policymakers, not monetary policymakers, but fiscal policymakers, where they're going to start to fight for control over how their economies work. And we feel that that's probably the beginning. We wouldn't want to be senior bank management anywhere in the world right now because they're going to have a tough road to hoe.
So let me back up for a second. We'll go all the way back to these $1.7 trillion in bank reserves held at the Fed, and you say there's $20 trillion in assets on the books of the banks right now. That looks highly levered. I've heard some analysts say that, you know, those $1.7 trillion in reserve assets sitting around over at the Fed, that's like hot money that someday could just come racing out of the gate and go do things, like if the banks really wanted to start lending against that. Are you saying that's already fully lent against?
Well, it's high-powered money, as they say, right? It's M0. And theoretically, they could use that as collateral, if you will, off which to lend further. Okay, but they already have lent $20 trillion on it. And so the incremental earnings that they will produce from lending more on that are dubious, number one. And number two, the $20 trillion in assets that they have on the book, which are loans made to the public, you know, imply leverage in private sector balance sheets. So the incentives there to expand private sector balance sheets also seems dubious. We're already leveraged, and if we're to leverage further, which we certainly could, there's going to have to be much more incentive to do that. The reason that I suggested the first phase is bank deleveraging is because we think that banks are going to have to deliver before anything approaching a helicopter drop, which would be that obviously implies that's a poor phrase because there's nothing like that, but it obviously implies distributing new currency to the public, to debtors, not to creditors, not to creditor banks, but to the public. You know, that would obviously shift obligations from private sector borrowers, probably to the Fed, making the Fed and other central banks that do it the bad bank, and that would then, in all likelihood, initiate a new round of credit expansion, which we have come to think of as an economic cycle. But we think that those incentives, the lack of incentives for growth, the lack of incentives for growth provide the largest hurdle that we're seeing now.
Well, this is certainly an extraordinarily unusual period of time, at least compared to the last four decades, where in the U.S. we saw total credit market debt just double again and do it so reliably that it's a perfect exponential curve from 1970 through to 2008, where we had this breakage in that model. And right now, credit creation is stalled. We're neither really advancing nor declining, and that's because non-financial debt is still sort of increasing as we watch governments, particularly the U.S. government, really go deep in the hawk to try and keep this going. And the shadow banking system looks like it's shedding, its debt loads pretty rapid pace. And they're sort of at a standstill, more or less. But what we're not doing is continuing to grow our credit markets at these very high percentage rates, 6%, 7%, 8% per year, just very reliably. And so that alone is a giant shift in how debt is operating, how money is operating, what the kind of flows that we're used to seeing, how we've structured all our markets around these types of flows. So are you suggesting here that if we're going to get there, you said there's two things. One, increase bank reserves. Two, increase physical currency. Let's get to that in a minute. But the idea here is that you're saying until and unless we can get those animal lending spirits back in the game, we're going nowhere, potentially even with risks of forced deleveraging waiting in the wings, potentially?
I think that's right. I think the markets force the deleveraging. I don't think it's the marketplace forces deleveraging. And there are two ways to deleverage. One is to let credit deteriorate on its own in the marketplace. And the other is to manufacture new currency, bank reserves. And those are the only two ways to deleverage a balance sheet. And so the way, that's what we're seeing. That's what we should expect in the future. It's already a well-entrenched trend that we're seeing of deleveraging. What policymakers don't want to see is bank asset deterioration. That would lead to all sorts of bad things, as your listeners would imagine. You would see banks fail. You would see bank systems fail. You would see debtors fail. And it would just feed on itself in an accelerating fashion. And so monetary policymakers have no choice but to deleverage in the other way, which is to colloquially print money, manufacture electronic credits and call them bank reserves. And to the degree that that extends into the private sector, where debtors begin to fail en masse, that would increase failures of the bank assets in turn, and within the mortgage-backed securities markets, for example, and the levered loan markets and the private sector shadow banking system, they would start to fail as well, and those creditors reduce to pensioners, because if a money manager or a pension fund owns mortgage-backed securities, for example, well, it all reduces to the pensioner that's behind them. So it doesn't work for anybody to have credit deteriorate. The only way to deleverage an economy is, as we're saying, to create new money with which to do it, create new base money with which to do it.
So we're seeing that Europe's doing what it can do. I mean, I think first they chewed through German savings, and now they're going to get down to the business of maybe printing a little more. They're easing for sure. We'll see if they get to printing. Bank of Japan obviously has been very aggressive at getting through its program of keeping its currency weak if possible through printing. The Fed punted on its last FOMC meeting, obviously just you know, I guess they went for a little more Operation Twist, but that really is balance sheet neutral. Do you think there is more balance sheet expansion in the Fed's future? And secondarily, are they going to be late to the game? Should they have already begun that process, say, at the last FOMC meeting?
Well, it depends what they're looking for. Obviously, we think that they should have deleveraged years ago. In a practical sense, I don't want to get into fractional reserve banking, its merits and risks. I don't want to get into hard money and its merits and risks. That's not what we're talking about today. But in the current framework of what we have and what we're dealing with, practically speaking, they should have deleveraged years ago. They should have printed money and destroyed currencies years ago, certainly in 2008, if their goal was to induce growth as quickly as possible. They should have deleveraged years ago. So I do think that once Operation Twist runs off, if not sooner, they will go to QE. I think that the Fed has had somewhat of the ability to delay because we've seen this nominal growth. We haven't gone into recession. We've had issues in Europe that make the U.S. seem healthy by comparison, and all the focus seems to be on Europe in terms of risk. However, the marketplace and the markets are not forcing the Fed to act. You know, banks have been reporting positive earnings. And are expected to. And so there's no proverbial gun to the head of central bankers suggesting that they move quickly. There hasn't been a significant swoon in the capital markets. We see stocks, you know, keeping their bid over time. We're seeing low interest rates, which in our view are not sending the signal that deflation is coming, and we can get back to that. But are very synthesized, and we're seeing real estate, you know, just it's stopped trading, and so we're not seeing a terrible quick fall in nominal prices of housing, and we're seeing newfound interest in buying more commercial real estate. So I don't think there's been a gun to central bankers' head to go in and do QE. I think the outcome is absolutely set in stone, and that is they have to do that, and they have to do it until such time as they transfer enough of the obligations to their own balance sheet to make the banking system healthy again.
I won't hold you to this, but if you have any back-of-the-envelope calculations, how big of an expansion do you think that is when all is said and done?
Oh, I think they're going to have to get close to the $20 trillion. It's you know, I don't know how in bank assets. I think they're going to have to, for all the world, look as though they are reserving bank assets. So, you know, whether they're allowed by the markets to do it incrementally, or whether they have to have some policy administered deleveraging, which obviously would be a devaluation of the currency, is up to the markets. I can't say what extent that goes to. What we've been seeing so far is the mechanism of debt monetization. That's a central bank just can't print money out of thin air and distribute it. They've got to buy something for which they print money, and then they print the proceeds and distribute the proceeds. That's the way it works. And so what they've been buying is debt. They've been buying treasuries. They've been buying mortgage-backed securities. They've been buying what seems to all the world to be high-quality debt. And they've been manufacturing the new money and then distributing that. Now, they've been distributing in the U.S. only to banks. They haven't been distributing it to debtors or to society, but that's the way that the mechanism they use to print money. A devaluation would entail buying assets and printing new currency with which to buy assets. And, you know, as a mind exercise, I don't think this would ever happen, but if the United States, so let's go to Europe. If the ECB or if Greece tomorrow decided that it was going to sell Mykonos to China so that China could put a deep water port to house their aircraft carriers, and they were going to charge China, let's make up another number, let's say $1 trillion. For Mykonos or some other island to do that. Well, they'd be out of debt. They would have sold, but the point here is they would have sold an asset. They would have received yuan or they would have received dollars that, you know, $1 trillion in China's bank reserves. And they'd be out of debt. They'd be the most solvent of all the European members. Will that happen? Obviously not. It won't be allowed, but the point here is you can either monetize debt or you can monetize assets. Okay, in this very poor example, now Mykonos or an island would be an asset. Same is true in the United States. You can do this anywhere. You can sell assets. You can sell Alaska for $16 trillion and retire U.S. Treasury debt. Obviously, no one has $16 trillion to buy it, and we would never do that. Or you can sell an asset on the balance sheet already of, or revalue an asset on the balance sheet already of the Treasury or the Fed. And obviously that asset we think is gold. And that's the monetary asset that they've always reverted to in the past, and that's the one we think that currencies, currently baseless currencies, will be devalued against. And so that we think is the mechanism that is ultimately going to play out, whether in the marketplace or through some policy-administered devaluation. Currencies are going to be devalued. And that's where we sit right now. Timing this is impossible. We think the amount it has to be devalued by, getting back to your original question, has got to be the amount of, or something close to the amount of the gap between bank assets and bank reserves. So it's a significant number.
It's a big number. So as a first step, you're thinking probably a little more of the same, where in this example, what's happening is the central banks will continue to buy debt instruments, also known as assets, in this confusingly in this story, because what we call assets and debt are the same thing in the banking world. For some people, that's confusing. At any rate, the first step would be a little more balance sheet expansion using the typical vehicles, trying more of the same. It's just basically keeping our noses just out of the above the waterline. As a second step, you're saying we have to obviously we can revalue against an asset. So Mykonos or Alaska, or what do banks have? Well, they really only have two things on their balance sheet. They have a whole bunch of debt instruments, and they've got gold. That's it. So gold in this case is Alaska, and you're saying that what we would do is see as a probable, the only way out of this, you're saying, there's really, it's inflate or die, to make it very simple. The die part is this: we have this forced, market-forced deleveraging. It's a self-feeding spiral to nowhere good. It's a very destructive process. It's going to be avoided at all costs. Let's be honest, central banks don't actually have any physical limits on what they can do, maybe only political limits or market limits. And if they coordinate well enough, there's really no, there are no market limits, because which market would rebel, I guess. So what you're, is that roughly correct? And you're saying that in this story, we don't know when, timing's hard, but we're going to have to devalue the currencies. It's really the only way out of this particular story at this stage, as you see it.
That's exactly right, Chris. And, you know, if Treasury ministries literally own the gold, we see them as and being the ultimate issuers or obligors on the hook for currency repayment. We see them as lending the gold to their central banks so that this mechanism, this asset monetization, devaluation can take place. And so we think it's the only way out, ultimately. And, you know, we'll see that happen either in the marketplace or through proclamation at some point. It's really what has to happen. And this couldn't have happened, by the way. Let me also tear down a bit the analog of the 1930s to today. The reason that central bank could not do this in the 1930s was because gold was already money. It was already backing money. Today, as you point out, that's not the case, and so there's no physical limitation on the amount of currency that central banks may manufacture. And so this is a completely viable way to deleverage the system. And it's by purely destroying the currency that we have. And they're debt currencies, so we're going to destroy the debt in real terms behind them, but not destroy them in nominal terms. That's the net effect of all this.
Destroy them in real terms, but not nominal terms.
And in other words, the purchasing power of the currencies will be destroyed. Yet all the, you'll still have the dollars, you'll still have the euros, you'll still have the yen in your pocket. And you'll have quite a bit more. So the nominal price of assets denominated in these currencies, if anything, will probably rise, certainly not fall, because there will be more currency chasing these assets. However, the purchasing power of things that you can buy with these currencies will fall dramatically. So if shares of General Electric or IBM or Google or Apple rise 10 or 15%, that's all great, and it will keep the nominal balance sheet solvent of pension funds and investors. However, you may have a head of lettuce that sells at the supermarket for $30. So clearly, levered financial assets will not keep pace, in our view, with the general price level. And that is the crux of the matter. It's solving for real returns as opposed to solving for nominal returns.
Interesting. So if we hold gold as one of these assets, are you making the case here that this is a good time to get involved in other hard assets? Commercial real estate came up already in this conversation. Is this time to take advantage of generationally low interest rates, lock up some assets and wait for this inevitable devaluation? Is that one way to protect yourself?
It's a bit tricky. Real estate used to be real. And by that I mean since the advent of the mortgage-backed securities market, and certainly I was a part of that, and new technologies and innovations, what we have today is the ability of private investors to act as creditor. So in effect, a pension fund that allocates a certain percentage of its capital to a large mutual fund or money manager, who then takes that capital and invests in the mortgage-backed securities market, is acting as creditor. And this has made the funding of real estate very broad-based. Many of the funders of real estate today, both residential and commercial, are leveraged. They're actually borrowing effectively from the banking system money, in effect credit, with which they buy mortgage-backed securities. Buying the mortgage-backed securities, in turn, increases or at least maintains the value, the equity value of the real estate, of the building, if you will. So in effect, the asset values that underlie the market, where it's priced today, are in large part contingent upon the overnight funding of those assets. So what was once upon a time a term funded, meaning 30-year, whatever it may have been, a very well-funded or outright for cash when more homeowners owned a greater percentage of their homes in equity, has become really a financial asset. And that all reduces the marginal value of a home or the marginal value of a commercial real estate reduces to the overnight funding provided by the banking system. I don't know if that's too obtuse, but if you think through it, a hedge fund that goes out and buys MBS, mortgage-backed securities, or commercial mortgage-backed securities, or leveraged loans that are backing real estate, or something of that nature, can only its NAV, that hedge fund's NAV, relies upon the ability to fund itself overnight through the banking system. So what is the value of the home or of the strip mall that flows through to the hedge fund? Or it completely depends on the funding, and it's become overnight funding. It's not term funding. So it's a long-winded way of saying, is commercial real estate or is housing or, you know, or residential real estate a good place to put your money? Well, it depends on, A, if it's term funded, and B, if the bid for that real estate relies on overnight funding. If it's term funded, then that's good. You know, you bought it well, it's funded well, you're not going to be taken out of your property if things get squirrely overnight. That's good. However, if the value of your asset, the value of your real estate relies on the continued overnight funding of anyone that might potentially come in to buy your real estate, then we'd argue, well, you may have a difficult time because it's a market. So we're not too sure that real estate is the cleanest way to play inflation. It's become a very mismatched funded market over the last 20 years.
So, of course, extraordinary timing issues, but sake of argument, it's October, say, and all of a sudden there's an announcement, Federal Reserve in cahoots with the ECB, Bank of England, maybe Japan, they all get together and they say, hey, we've decided to sort of really go into this next round of printing, and we're going to do it, pick a number, $5 trillion as a next starting point. That's what we're doing. We're going to wade right in, and we're going to buy more assets, in this case mortgage-backed securities, more sovereign debt, whatever's lying around out there that they want to go and grab. Would that be a moment that you would, in my world, that's a moment where that, like a starter pistol that says, get rid of your cash reserves, go buy stuff, of which real estate might be an example?
It may be. Again, though, you know, you could be right, and certainly there might be a very good trade there. At the end of the day, real estate has always come down to demographics, and whether or not you'll have more investors or homeowners coming in to borrow to buy real estate at whatever prices they're at, you know, seems to me to be unknown. So you may be right, but it's not as clear to me as other types of investments, only because the real estate market is already a very leveraged and mismatched market. It's certainly going to be better than other forms of investment. I would argue, you know, such as, you know, any bond with duration to it and potentially cash, you know, where we see great risk. So, you know, it could be better, but we don't have any real insight into the amount of leverage necessary or re-leveraging necessary to drive up, collateral values or asset values.
Yeah. Well, I'm with you on that. Recommend very strongly gold as the first order in this story, the first piece that we should talk about, mainly because I'm a little bit Austrian when it comes down to where we are in this story. I truly believe that quote from von Mises that when you're in a credit bubble, there's really only two paths forward. One is a voluntary abandonment of the credit expansion or a final catastrophe of the currency involved. So maybe catastrophe is a strong word, but if we include in that a pretty significant devaluation, I think that's in the cards as well. And there, the reason I like gold is, you know, it's got all this history and everything, but it's money. It's an alternative money and money-like asset that's not simultaneously a liability somewhere else in this story. And on that basis, it's simpler. It's easier to understand. As you've mentioned, you know, there's a lot of things impinging on the real estate market, ranging from demographics, timing, how it's funded these days. So it's beholden to liquidity cycles, local geography, you name it. There's complexity in that. Gold is a relatively simple story, and also, I think, more profound in that in many ways, because it's pointing to what I think the heart of this crisis really is, which is, it's a monetary crisis at heart. We've run a debt-based money system right to its very edge, and we're going to keep pushing because we don't know what else to do. So we'll do that. And I can't see any other way around that unless we're willing to. at the global level say, hey, we're willing to talk about whole brand new currency systems that are maybe predicated on something other than this thing we've been doing for the past 100 years. I don't even see the beginnings of those conversations anywhere, but at the bare fringes of the blogosphere. So I'm not too worried about that cropping up. I just think we're going to continue within the system as it's designed. The sorts of solutions and policy ranges that we'll have will increasingly be both less palatable and desperate looking as we are, you know, we're well past the stage of twine and Band-Aids and chewing gum. We're just doing whatever's necessary. When I talked with Steve Keen a couple of weeks ago, he said the main policy of the central banks right now really reduces to one word. It looks like panic to him. So they're just trying stuff, and that's my great faith that we will continue to try something long after it's been proven to be, shall we say, self-destructive in some way. And gold to me is really the cornerstone of sidestepping almost any possible policy response I can envision happening next, and maybe even advancing our positions a little bit, but preserving and wealth preservation being the cornerstones of my philosophy at this stage, where if we are where I think we are in this story, one possible statement is he who loses least wins most. And that certainly was true in other great inflationary epics back in Weimar or Zimbabwe. Pick them. There's so many examples we could just start rattling them off. So I'm wondering in closing if you agree with that view. It's just, is it a question of simplicity? And is this really a monetary crisis at heart?
I agree with that unequivocally, Chris. And I would say that, you know, you can invest in gold when it's undervalued relative to baseless money. Ordinarily, you would save in gold because it's money, as you suggest. Today, gold, in our view, is a wonderful investment because there is a fundamentally ridiculously cheap arbitrage where that is, in our view, collapsing the spread between bank assets and bank reserves. It's that simple, and we think it has to happen, and we think that, as you point out, central bankers are beginning to recognize that there is no policy that can overcome that because you have debt payments to make. There is no fiscal policy. I think politicians are soon to understand that neither austerity nor stimulation, tax code changes, anything can promote enough growth to get out of this debt trap. And so I would agree completely with your assessment. And, you know, that's the way we're proceeding. And it's a terrible challenge to try and time this. And so we've stopped trying. We don't any longer. We're just holding on and watching as it plays out. I think it's very important to keep in mind that policymakers are holding the burning match, not investors in precious metals, gold, and other natural resources, scarce natural resources. And they're holding the burning match because they're the ones that are trying to perpetuate the leverage, not us, not those of us that are invested in gold. And so I think that the prudent thing to do is to take a step back and to hold it, and in either bullion form or in precious metal miner form, because that's gold in the ground, physical gold in the ground, without anyone in between you and your gold, and just wait and watch how it plays out. Hope for the best, but you know there's only, in our view, one outcome that we'll see.
Well, fantastic. As always, this is just very interesting, and I'm so glad to have your depth of knowledge and be able to talk through these issues. It's a lot of complexity out there, but I think we have to understand that in order to know where we are in this story. It is a complex story. It's a complex system, but it has a simple solution at the end. So thank you again for your time. And if people, anybody's interested in your fund or following you more closely, how would they do that?
Well, I would suggest they maybe contact you. And we'll put out, we don't take investors from the public, and we don't hold ourselves out to be investment advisors. So I'm happy to provide information to you, and I think that might be the best way to go about doing it.
All right. Well, fantastic. Hey, thanks again, and enjoy your upcoming weekend.
Thank you, Chris. You too.